welcome to another episode of From the Hip with me, Benji Moody. To start off, I'd like to paraphrase journalist Dion Marcer's liner notes for the Elemental CD reissue back in 2004, just to set the scene about South African music in the 80s. There was Rocky 24, the Oxford Hotel, and the Chelsea. It was a time when Yeovil, Rosebank, and Hillbrow were different places than what they are today. It was a time when jawling was dangerous, where police tear gas clubs and right-wingers slashed tires at rhythm against detention gigs. It was a time when musicians were jailed for singing pro-Mandela songs. Hell, it was a time when South Africans didn't even know what he looked like. Maybe it was the paranoia, or perhaps that everyone came from somewhere else and could hang around in 24-hour coffee shops like Café de Paris in Hillbrow, but a creative burst surged through rock in South Africa, unequal to this day. Where the Windrich brothers of Air Void were looking at Africa with their junk jive rhythms, and Petit Cheval's John Selby was stalking the stage channeling Lord Byron, Elemental were looking at theatre. They combined strong melodies and punchy guitar riffs with theatrical elements like creative lighting, mime, and costumes. Watching Heather Mack was unlike watching any other lead vocalist of the time. Poised dramatically under strong lights that isolated her from the rest of the band, strong arm movements reminiscent of pre-war Berlin performance art. And it was only her voice that kept on reminding you that you were actually listening to a rock band. My guests in this episode are lead singer Heather Mack and guitarist Tim Parr of the legendary Elemental. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. How's it, Benj?
Thank you.
Tim, of course, I met you in the late 70s first when you were the guitarist in one of the best rock bands at that time, which is Backstop, who incidentally were the first group that I signed. When I was at Weir Records, I think I was 21 when I signed Backstop. I've always wanted to know, why was the band so short-lived?
I think there was trouble with Fuzzy's wife put the foot down and said, listen, it's either me or the band. So Fuzzy was the first one to leave the band. There was an ultimatum given and Backstop broke up. Sounds ridiculous, eh? And we were also very naive business-wise. I mean, it wasn't going anywhere.
Heather, talk us through your formative musical years. Did you always want to be a singer?
From a very early age, I sang in choirs at both of my primary and high school. And I also was intrigued and by musicals since I was a very, very little girl. And went and spent many hours watching Singing in the Rain and that kind of thing. So very inspired by the aspect of bringing music into a theatrical feeling rather than just straight theatre. And that was where I was coming from. I had just finished a show at the Baxter, and then I landed in Johannesburg, and the former boyfriend at that time who introduced me to Tim and to Larry was a troubadour called Ronnie Domp, who I used to hang out with Neil Solomon and Ronnie at a place called the Uptown Rhythm Dolls, actually. They were called then, still with Tony, and I bought my first bass. So when I left for Johannesburg for the Ballyhoo tour, which Ronnie was actually supporting for their Man on the Moon tour, he said, you're a great singer. Let's do a couple of songs. Come with me up on stage and blah, blah. So I landed up singing, and that's when I was introduced to Tim and Larry after the gig at Mangles in Braamfontein, and the rest is history.
And Tim, I mean, after Backstop, did you go out with the intention of forming another band?
Yeah, I did. When Backstop broke up, I went to Amsterdam, and I was there for about, I don't know, 3-4 months. And when I came back, I put a band together with George Vardis, played bass, put together a rhythm section with the two Causa brothers, Punka and Gary Causa. Oh, Larry Friedberg was on drums before that. And Glenn Kalis, I went through quite a few different bass players, playing Rocky 24, playing blues and playing those kind of songs back in the days when I was a bluesman.
What I find fascinating about South African music is that musicians pass in and out of each other's lives and bands. I didn't know that an early incarnation of Elemental had Gary and Punk, of course, from National Wake, who was also a band that I signed in 81.
Well, in the early days, Tim actually asked me to join him and sing harmonies. And then there were a couple of songs. So it was still called the Tim Parr Band. So I was basically the backing vocalist, and that was really good experience for me in a very different situation of clubs and pubs and one or two extraordinary events where we got told, come on, we've got a gig in Uppington with the big motorcycle rally, you know, and we land up there with Gary and Punker, and we're told, well, they can't come into the hotel. And then we had to do a whole lot of weird shit to try and get them in and distract the receptionist so that they could. And then we would the stories, it could fill a book, definitely. But soon thereafter, I started to really take up a lot more space in more ways than one. And Elemental Form was renamed. Timpar Band was renamed. And I landed up actually singing 95% of the songs.
When you met each other and you started working together, was it a meeting of similar musical mind?
When I saw Heather sing at Mangles that night where I met her, I remember asking her that night, I said, look, I'm writing all these songs. I'd like you to come and sing them. And that's where we actually started working together. Soon after that, we would get together and I would start teaching her songs.
How did the name Elemental come up?
D.H. Lawrence was one of my great authors. I also adored some of his poems. One of them, which is a poem called Elemental, and it's about people being true to their spirit and soul and realizing that the elements are a reflection of the actual natural elements are a reflection of the human spirit as well. Roddy Quinn was the one who said, I think it needs to actually be changed into a girl's name. So it's Elemental. So that's how it landed up being the ELLA, capital M.
Ah, cool. That's a nice little story, that. Because I always pronounce it Elemental, you know, as one word. It's actually Elemental.
Yeah.
At this stage, the songs that became part of the album, were they starting to grow in the band? I mean, is that how the writing process worked? I know, Tim, you did a lot of writing.
Completely, yeah. I mean, there was many songs that Tim had come and brought to the band. And then there were ones that evolved. As you say, it became a place where Tim might come with a riff or I might have written some words and I wanted to see whether we could add it to, you know, like a song like Monsters was literally a reflection of some of my experience as a child growing up. And then you have this fantastic group of musicians who take it and I'm able to play and Tim would come with songs and we'd all be able to play around. When I say play around, it's literally jamming and saying, that sounds fantastic. I like that. That's a hook. That could be a hook for people to really want to get into the song and sing along as well. So there's always that aspect of generating energy with the audience in mind. Certainly for me, it was important. The connection with an audience is for me the most inspiring space and place to be. I'm a very different person off the stage. When I'm on the stage, something very different happens to me. It's definitely the audience that I am willing to come along and draw into a journey and an experience, almost like we would have in a rehearsal space.
I also wrote a lot of songs, but more in Ireland, where I would write pieces of songs and then kind of lose interest, and then Heather would take them and take them further, you know? Quite a lot of songs like that. Mm.
So you mutated from the Timpar Band, you come up with Elemental. Once Herman Eugster and Adrian Levi were in the band, that's the classic lineup of Elemental.
Yeah.
Was Elemental a democracy?
Well, we tried in the beginning, where we shared the royalties with everyone, and that came to, when Billy Gaff heard that we had done that, he freaked out and said, you never do that. But the first album we did, Heather and I wrote all the songs. We shared the royalties equally with everyone. We were told one does not do that.
So who was in charge?
I think Heather thinks she was in charge. I think I was in charge of the music.
No, that is hilarious.
Heather, at this stage, once the music was all coming together, did you have a clear idea on how you wanted to portray yourself on stage?
Completely.
When you get on stage, you change.
Yes. The kind of influence when I was growing up as a teenager was definitely someone like a Bowie. that on some level, even though you never got the journalism that you get now, and certainly you don't have the Instagrams and the Facebooks and seeing the real people behind the stage persona, but the idea of a theater is about slipping into that costume, putting on the mask of, and playing roles. And that actually each song for me was a character that slipped into it and understood what we were trying to say. And to extend that from a theatrical point of view is a little bit more of method actor, as well as the thing of making sure that the song's message connects, that it's not just let's just rock and rock and rock and rock and rock and rock and rock, but actually that you could, as we did, go into a theater and watch us and not get bored. I would step into different costumes, literally, not just in the in an emotional, spiritual sense. If to assist me would be about putting on that jacket or putting on that suit. There was a lot of sexism for a woman, and for Tim to say he thinks that maybe I thought I was managing the band. I wasn't, not at all. Never did think so. But certainly, I felt that women were and still are really put in their place. And so the Grammys this year was just so phenomenal because it really felt like there was a major shift. They'd be stupid if they didn't start to see the power of what's coming through women. So rock for me was mainly run by men. And at times I didn't even get upset about it. I was so in it and of it. And it took time and distance to recognize when I was with the band again this last year that there is still, you know, within that particular lineup, a sense of we are the men and we run this thing. And it's not meant in any way a negative thing. It's something that my daughter and I talk about from time to time. She is still in England feeling that same sense of women being marginalized in rock. And whatever the, you know, unless you start your own business like a Beyonce or whatever, there is a sense of that. And I think our band in Ireland were so different. The band that we put together in Ireland were mature men, most of which were older than us. They had the gift of the Irish. They loved their mothers. And there was more of a sense of me being part of them rather than that sense of, Heather, fantastic outfit. That's great. Yeah, you look gorgeous. You're great. And get out there and do your thing. And I do. And I will always do that on some level. That's some of my reflections over the last year.
Evident the role playing in the Live at Sun City video, which I watched this weekend on YouTube. I didn't even know it existed. And I had such a gas watching it because it's an amazing show. I mean, the playing is superb at that show. What do you remember about the Sun City gig?
Ooh, I just had a baby.
Luke was 6 weeks old. Heather was exhausted.
She could have fooled me.
It would have been amazing if we had not done it, actually. Journalists were sent up there and told that they must slag us whether we're good or bad. They really looked after us. They gave us really great accommodation, and I think we played better on the second night.
Let's talk about getting signed to EMI, right? It happened, I think, relatively quickly for Elemental, didn't it?
We had a fantastic manager at the time, Sue Carroll. She was really profound in the sense that she believed 100% in us. We lost something in her in the EMI signing because suddenly there was a Quinn in the audience, and very shortly thereafterwards, probably within a week, Roddy had chatted to Tim and I and the band and said, you have to come on board. And once that happened, it was like, well, there was no room for Sue. That to me is again another indicator of how quickly in those days people can get burnt by this industry. And I will always shout out to Sue wherever she is to say thank you, because she gave us jet propulsion for a period of around 9 months. Powerful journalist who used to work at the Rand Daily Mail. So I don't know where she is, but it's a shout out. So it felt very quick. And the signing thereof obviously happens really quickly. We were such entrepreneurs. We had no idea what we were doing. We were signing over our life and our songs completely to EMI. And EMI is still being paid to this day, 40 years later. You know, there's a couple of songs that do get played and replayed. I don't think Tim gets the royalties.
I got 78 Rand royalty from Sam.
Really? Hey? Wow.
December, 78 Rand.
Yeah, I remember Sue Carroll as being a dynamic manager.
She was a cool chick.
Very dynamic.
Yeah, she was. She was really cool. She really believed in us. And I've tried to trace for years now just to say thank you. And
me too.
While I was writing this episode, I was looking online, couldn't find her anywhere. So you started work on the album with Mally Watson. Tim, the fact that he was also a guitarist, did that assist you in getting your parts right?
Absolutely. Going to the studio there, and he had already written it in those days. It was a DMX or a Linn drum for a click, and he let us know he's the producer. And we were kind of told what to do, and we were so naive, we just went along with it.
So you had no influence on what it sounded like?
No, not really. He was the one who brought in Peps to do keyboard parts, and it was always very professionally done. But I think all the recordings never really captured what Elemental was like live, you know.
The debut single was Pressure, came out as a 12-inch. I remember I've got the 12-inch at home with some live tracks on it, which I think came from the Chelsea recordings. It was unlike anything else around at that time. I mean, and still sounds incredibly punchy and still vibrant. Was that basically cut live, Tim?
Yes, that's the straight recording, no overdubs. That was it. Two-track recording from the desk for Shaughnessy. I know that Neil Solomon's actually got a couple of reels of one-inch tape there from some of those recordings from the Chelsea.
What was the media reaction to Elemental when Pressure came out? You had that look together already.
Adrian hadn't joined us yet, and George Vardis had a big part in that recording. We got a lot of good press. We were also playing a lot in not just the Chelsea. There was a theatre place called 52 and then 52-something. There was
58 and Hillbrow.
Heather went down a storm there, and the word spread.
The whole thing exploded, of course, with See Yourself, which was a huge hit. I mean, was that a surprise to you, or did you know in the back of your mind when you cut that, this is a monster?
No, didn't know that.
No, I think the trigger happened with Clowns because of the concert in the park. I think that it really took off in a very different way once that film was made and it was released. We didn't just get press. Television was kind of kicking off. And we got invited to Pop Shop quite often. We got invited to Martin Bailey had some Sunday show that Patience Stephen was producing. We got invited to a number of different interviews that were live on television as well as performances. So it was not just printing. And again, how I wish I could get hold of some of those SABC recordings that are moldering away somewhere in the vaults, if they're still there. Just in terms of the fact we have so little. If Tim and I kind of opened a box, it would literally be just a little cardboard box. And my husband's got my box, my Elemental box. So it is quite unfortunate that that time there was no such thing as what we have now. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, imagine.
The sad thing is that all those videos of everybody, I mean, you know, of you, Avoid, Via Africa, they're all gone.
That whole time.
I actually went to the vault at the SABC about 10 years ago looking for material when I was doing the Retro Fresh series. And I spent the whole day and I could find nothing until somebody said to me, oh, no, all those tapes are wiped and reused. Yeah, very, very sad. You had hit singles, you had an album selling by the bucket load, you had sold out shows. In bands, there's always friction between the two main musicians, which is the lead singer and the guitarist. The guitarist feels that the lead singer is taking all the limelight, the lead singer wants the limelight all the time. Did that dynamic happen in Elemental? Was it friction, or was it kind of accepted that, for instance, you, Heather, were the front person and were in the limelight?
I think there was friction, especially when we went to Ireland, where it was, although I wrote a lot of the songs, it was always just about Heather. And yet the actual work, when we worked together, when we did work together, we got a lot of done. We worked really hard on stuff, you know, getting those songs right. We worked very hard on harmonies. Yes, we worked hard in that initial stage together. And I think it was pretty much accepted that Heather, because she was the front liner. But people also knew that I was the main songwriter, and it kind of balanced out, you know.
Mm.
But in Ireland, it became very much all about Heather. And yet I was the one sitting in the back room every night writing, you know. Oh, I used to get so frustrated. And then we weren't allowed to play. You know, we Billy Gaff wouldn't allow us to go out and play. We rehearsed at Lytton Lane for 18 months without doing a gig. I got so frustrated, I went and put a blues band together of Irish musicians and went out and played secretly, you know.
I'm going to come to the Billy Gaff thing later. I think it's hard for lead singers because, you know, they're always in front, always in the light, pretty much exposed. I mean, how do you feel as a lead singer?
Such an interesting thing to listen to, Tim, and because obviously we don't spend any time in many years, Tim and I. So it is interesting having his reflection for me to consider the fact that in South Africa, this was still so new to me. I mean, I was extremely enthusiastic. I just wanted to go for it. There was nothing that would put me down. I was a very, very enthusiastic rocker. That's what I wanted to be. I wanted to sing and be in the front line. It was, for me, I never felt it at any point it was taking over my life. I'd go back home, drink a cup of tea. The following morning, I'd wear very cuck old pajama pants and roll down bloody Rocky Street to the Checkers. I lived my life very honestly in terms of in my terms. So that I would have people come up to me. Aren't you Heather Mack? I said, yeah. Wow. Can I, you know, yes, please. I want you to go. And I'm like, what the fuck? And then, you know, things changed quite radically for me when I became pregnant. Because for me, the big issue was my child at that point, one child so far. I don't think that Tim really understood what impact it had on me to, in fact, birth this child. And then shortly thereafter, literally within 5 days, have Roddy Quinn coming into the hospital saying, we've got an offer. Bucks Fizz have pulled out because of the apartheid shit and embargoes. So you guys, we were going to support Bucks Fizz. You guys are going to get the show. You're going to take the show and you're going to do two nights at the Sun City. And I was like, you know, breastfeeding. I was trying to do all the things that I fantasized about doing if, now having made the decision, I want to be a mother. You know, I don't think that there's enough talk between Tim and I of this time in our life and what impact it had on me. And certainly when people say it's all about Heather, it was what Billy Gaff wanted. Billy Gaff saw me as his next Rod Stewart or his next John Cougar Mellencamp. He wanted to break us into the big time, and he knew that the band would come with me. I did not appreciate that, but on some level, he was a typical Irishman, and he would keep on saying, well, Heather, how's your little Baron? Oh, he's lovely. Oh, he's a lovely Baron. Hello, look. You know, and he made us come and stay with him at his fantastic manor. He seemed so concerned, but you know, in time, I realized what it was doing to us as a whole is his intense focus on me and how it probably impacted on Tim. Can what history be rewritten? No, it is what it is. And we went this on this journey, and I think it was conflicting often for me as a person who loved to perform, but on the same side, I was trying to be a mother.
The fact that you were in a relationship, how did that impact on the band?
Well, it's very hard. It's very hard to separate the two. We did. I thought we managed pretty well in the beginning, Heath, keeping them separate. But then it just takes over. When you're living with someone 24 hours a day, it becomes really hard because you carry the relationship on stage and you carry the stage into your relationship at home, and it just becomes too much. Mm. It did impact us.
Have you seen the documentary One Night in Music? The making of We Are the World.
Yes.
One Day in Music in South Africa was Concert in the Park.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And your performance that day is one of the standout performances when you watch it on YouTube or you watch the DVD of it. Elemental were at their peak, I think, at Concert in the Park. What do you remember about the show?
Meeting Annalene Krill on stage. I remember when we walked out on stage that the audience, the energy coming off the audience, I just cried. Eh? There was so much love coming off the audience. And I just cried. It was so powerful. Yeah.
And you, Heather, what do you remember most about it?
I just stepped into my costume. You know, funny that you bring this Concert in the Park up. I had discovered that I was pregnant. That was, you know, that was already in my mind at that time. And wow, I felt profoundly moved before I got on stage at Sun City, because my heroes like Liza Minnelli and Frank Sinatra had been on the stage. And, stages hold energy. And Concert in the Park, it felt like we were going, like we did some huge concerts in big areas before. So I didn't find myself that overwhelmed by it. I wasn't nervous at all. It was as if this moment had to happen. And more than anything, I was just so excited about the fact that it was a multiracial audience. that was the stuff that really touched me so deeply. Backstage and hanging out with people that I'd respected and knew, Steve Kakana and Brenda and all of us at the, you know, in the so-called green room, hanging out together. And I said, oh, you know, this is what I've fantasized and dreamed about for all of my time since I became more aware around 16, 17, I started to become 1976. A whole lot of new stuff came into my brain, information, chilling stuff that I had been oblivious to. And so to go to that stadium and finally find myself working with my peers, and they were peers that were usually put away and put it somewhere, like just the stuff that gives me chills even talking about it. That, for me, was the profound moment of Concert in the Park.
There's a scene in the One Night Music docu where Quincy Jones puts up a card on the door. It says, check your egos in at the door. Because you had everybody who was who's who in music in that room at one time on one night. Concert in the Park is kind of similar in the ways we had the cream of South African music. Elemental, A Void, Brenda Fassie, Sipho Hotstix, Mabuse, Petit Cheval, etc. all together on one day. What was that like in the green room? Were there ego issues at Concert in the Park?
I didn't feel them anyway. As I told you, I was blissed out, just like a big smile, you know, and every person that was walking around with a smile, you can't not smile at a person if they're smiling all the time. So that's my experience of the green room. Wonderful hellos and interest.
It's interesting when you look at it, because from a socio-political point of view, I mean, we were only 4 years away from democracy. And we didn't know it at the time in 1985. It was only another 4 years to go before things irrevocably changed over here. So it is a really big landmark. In fact, I'm planning a special, which is going to be the 40th, I think. Yeah, the 40th anniversary of Concert in the Park. After Concert in the Park, you made the decision to move to Ireland. Is that when it happened?
Mm-mm. No, we were asked to go. I mean, Billy had seen us in that December of 84. He wanted us to come. That's when I discovered I found out I was pregnant. Mm. Then the offer was kind of because of me on some level, because I said, I don't want to be away from my homeland and my family when I'm having this like profound opportunity to birth a child. So in fact, yeah, we kind of rejected it by May. When we were doing the Market Theatre, it was kind of like then when we said, absolutely not, we're not going to do this. Then the following year, because we approached Billy once there was another state of emergency the following July, by October we were already in Dublin.
How did you meet Billy Gaff?
He came out here with the head of EMI Publishing, and Roddy Quinn actually brought him round to meet us. I think he was out here with Lamal, whose single had broken all over the world. Do you remember?
It was Cape Town, definitely on our Cape Town. We would always go to Cape Town for about five shows, Christmas season, New Year season, and we were doing a club in Woodstock called Xanadu. And Lamal came with Billy to that gig. And thereafter, the gig, literally, immediately, we were told we have to go upstairs to the manager's lounge, and there was champagne on ice, the real good shit. He started wooing Tim and I and the band.
Well, I mean, he was a mega manager at that point. I mean, he had done, you know, Rod. I mean, John Cougar, who became John Mellencamp. It must have been a sense of elation and Elemental that somebody like that was interested in signing the band and getting the band to move to the UK.
Look, he was very good to us. I have fond memories beginning anyway. But whatever Billy tried to do for us, the cultural boycott always raised its head and put a stop to it.
When you got to Ireland, I mean, Ireland was a hotbed of political and social activism, particularly against apartheid. How were you received by the Irish musicians at large?
Carter Asmal connected with us and we became friends. Him and his wife, Louise, I mean, a bunch of them. We knew Greg Cutler from the Backstop days, and Greg Cutler was connected to Wally Cerotti and all these politicos. And so we met a whole lot of them. I mean, I carried a huge guilt about playing Sun City because of all the what we had gone through after we played, you know. And when I told Carter Asmal, we were having lunch with him one day in Ireland, and I told him that I'd played Sun City. And he said, "So what? You're a South African." But the lefties gave us a really hard time. Meanwhile, a lot of the Elemental songs were anti-apartheid songs.
How did Steve Van Zandt?
Roddy Quinn brought him round. He brought him round to the Oxford right. Hotel, yeah. And then we got on really well. I remember by the balalaika, my car broke down. I had Steve Van Zandt pushing my Mazda. "Come put your back into it, Steve." But he was a good guy, and he was fantastic in the studio, really.
What did he work on with you?
We wrote a song called 30 Million Lonely People.
An inspiration for that song, Heather?
Well, there was 30 million people in South Africa at the time that happened to be being oppressed by around 10 million whites or so. So, you know, us as colonialists have managed to make people disappear on many different levels. And how that sense of loneliness and separation really bear down on how we felt as musicians in this country. It became so apparent how many people were silent. So yeah, that was really what it was about. What was very funny, this was before we did Sun City. Very different mindset at the time doing the Sun City gig, because in many ways I would have preferred not to do it and stay at home looking after my six-week-old baby. However, we did it. And I certainly didn't feel engaged as much as I could have been with fighting against not doing it. By that stage, the wheels were turning really fast. And as I say, ironically, Steve came back and worked with a number of musicians for a song called "Ain't Gonna Play Sun City."
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that very well. What was the transition from being a huge group here at home to being, you know, relatively unknown in Ireland? Surely difficult to adjust to.
Oh, it was hard. That's all I'll say. Not the adjusting to adulation, but being away from my family and especially my mum, not knowing what's going to happen next. Absolutely no idea. Yeah, having a child who's just learning how to run and walk, and it's snowing, it's very cold, the heating unit doesn't work in the house that Billy's put us into. He's put us into this Lani house, which is so far from what Tim and I used to live like in South Africa. Oh, I could go on about this for very long, but certainly the frustration was, it was the fact that we could not go and perform anywhere. We'd made this huge leap, and we were writing some fantastic songs with Adrian and Herman, Billy was paying for the studio, so it was like having, like we always were, it was like a day job being a musician. We would rehearse every day of our life as Elemental. It wasn't like we like only rehearsed like maybe every Sunday, you know. It would be like work, write new songs together. That's what we did. And we did the same in Ireland, but with no outlet. And it really was the thing that triggered Herman and Adrian's frustration to leave us. And so they did.
Mm. What was his thinking in not letting you perform? What was Billy Gaff's thinking? I mean, it's the complete opposite of what a manager should be doing.
I think it was all about this anti-apartheid thing, cultural boycott. He would line things up for us, and then behind the scenes, we kind of fell apart. I think we played, 18 months rehearsing?
Sure.
It was a year in Lytton Lane. Then Billy got chased around the globe because Elton John's Red Boy scandal came out. And that's when we got pretty much dropped like a hot brick, because the boys, Adrian and Herman, only lived in Ireland, six months. We just said, literally, fuck this for a joke, and started to look around for Irish musicians because we weren't going to stop playing. So he was only being as generous as he was. He really was. I mean, he was giving us a certain amount of pounds to pay for food and rent. That's it. And we were getting by, just getting by on the skin of, whatever. I think the fact that suddenly we grew a massive following in Ireland, and in fact, Billy's Irish lawyer fell in love with our music and said, you know what, I'll continue paying you that amount, and you guys just get out there and do what you do best. So that was amazing, because that's what triggered the resurgence of Billy's interest, because we were packing out venues in and around Dublin.
Oh, so he came and went and then came back again?
Yep.
Sounds like a manager to me. Did the change of environment influence the way that you wrote songs?
Absolutely.
And the overall sound of Elemental by being in Ireland?
I started jamming with these incredible musicians. Dave McHale he toured with Bob Geldof in the Boomtown Rats all over the world. He was a pianist who could play classical and jazz, and he was an incredible alto sax player. And then we got this doctor dude, Kevin Strong, who was an amazing organ player. And then we even had a brass section. I mean, it was crazy. The one guy from The Commitments, the guy who played the manager, was our trumpet player. T.J. Tutty I had met in the blues band. And Robbie Brennan was this drummer who had played with Phil Lynott. And they were all a bit older than us, but they were incredible musicians, and they were very quick. It's something that I've been writing all these kind of African groovy songs, and the Irish music also kind of clicks quite easy with African rhythms. You know, all folk musics have a root, and the African folk music, like the Pekanga, comes from where the Zulu Maskanda players meeting with the Irish miners.
Yep, absolutely.
And we found that these Irishmen, once they knew where the one was, they just took to our music and they made it, and it was a whole different vibe of songs that came out. So Heather and I just followed it.
Every once in a while we arrive at a crossroad. Good opportunity. Do we lose it? Do we take it by the hand and hold on to what we've got or let go? Ocean tide. Don't shy. How many years have we suffered each other? How
Is that when the Warner Brothers deal happened?
We'd been in Ireland for 3 years before. One of the gigs that we'd played was the Marquee in London, and Kik Van Hengel, who was the Warner Brothers publishing dude in New York, he happened to be there. And that's where Billy Gap came back, when Kik Van Hengel got hold of him and said, listen, I've seen that band, we really want to sign them. And that's where Billy Gap's interest was sparked again. And they flew us to LA, Heather and I, and they schmoozed us. They didn't want to use the band. We fought to have the band brought over to America.
I told Billy that I was pregnant at the same time as we were about to sign the contract. And I said, I don't know if you want to really want me to sign this contract because I'm actually pregnant. And he said, don't you be worried, Heather. We'll manage it. You just sign on the dotted line and don't do nothing with that baby of yours. Keep that baby.
You did the self-titled album in L.A. with Stuart Levine, who did Simply Red and Joe Cocker and Masekela and everything.
Yeah.
What was that experience like? I mean, did he get what Elemental was it about?
No. He made it very clear right from the beginning that he was the producer and it's his way or the highway. I mean, we brought Rasenga Makonda from Amapondo over and he let him play on one session and he fired him, brought in Lenny Castro. And he just used these high-class musicians and did his own movie with it, you know. That's when it started with the royalties. I mean, you're a record company exec. You understand I think we were on 13% royalties. Then we were told that we paid Stuart Levine $75,000 and he would get 4 points for producing that would come from the record company. And then what they did, they took it from Heather and our royalties. And that's where we started feeling... No.
It's sad because there's some really good songs on that album. Song for Jenny, which I think is an amazing track. Was that an autobiographical song, Heather?
Yeah.
This was a friend of ours.
We wrote it pretty much within days of her car crash. And she was, in fact, going to be joining us. We'd been doing a couple of gigs, and I really loved her very much. She had a shop called Pearls, Jenny Gordon, in Melville. Great designer, and I've met her on a film shoot, and Tim was doing the sound for a film shoot, and we played and sang in the bathroom for ages together, just singing in harmony. So she started to become a kind of a semi-part of the band over the one tour to Cape Town, and she did a couple of gigs with us there, and she was in fact driving up to join us for the second concert in the pub, and that's when Jennifer got killed in a car crash. I'm still friends with her daughter. We met her. So that was that song, yeah.
The lack of success on that album must have been quite debilitating for you as musicians. Did that lead to you going, well, we're just going to go back home?
Well, no, we stayed and played music for another year. So we came back in.
Okay.
No, we didn't give up. The fact that it only sold, I think it was 50,000 altogether from Australia, some part of Germany, and some in North America. So there were sales of 50,000. And I feel like we're in very good company because exactly the same year, Warner Brothers was going through the initial stages of it becoming Time Warner. And there was a whole lot of cut going down where the big gents were coming in and saying, listen, we're going to have to put a ceiling on this. And so along with us went Nick Cave as well. And I think we're in good company.
Everyone who hadn't sold 500,000 got dropped.
What year was that?
1989. Yeah. And so when Billy kind of said he can't carry on, this is like an empty drain that he's not getting his money back. And I totally understood. I completely understood when he took, you know, we had a meeting in the Shelbourne and that in Ireland, in Dublin, and that was it. And we looked at each other and said, well, we're going to carry on. Let's do it. And we did.
Billy organized that one gig for us in Switzerland at Montreux Jazz Festival.
With Chuck Claude Knobs.
Did you play?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've got a record of it. I've actually, on VHS.
Okay.
Very well received. It was fabulous. We had so much fun.
And then you came back and you stayed?
Yes, I did.
Did you go back to Ireland, Tim?
Yeah, we decided to separate. So I went back and after 3 months, I came back again, missing my children. Then we got divorced, Heather and I.
You both continued. I mean, Tim, you put albums out. I'm Still Standing. You were part of the Zapdragons. So you continued. Heather, did you had an album out in, I think, 2011.
That's right.
With Green World or not?
Yes. I was doing a lot of theatre. I kind of went back to my first love and I had a children's theatre company. And I was also doing some very interesting kind of music theatre pieces that also were very successful at the Grandstand Festival and various other venues. But it was just not bringing enough money in for two children. I did a lot of jingles for Tally McCulley and Spaced Out Sound Studios. And so those were the little bits of money I would get in. So then this opportunity, Angie, who was the receptionist, she said, Heather, you actually you've got quite a brain on you. And I think you should go and talk to this Viv Gordon woman. And so off I went to an agent who usually places people in ad agencies. And she said, there's a job that's just waiting for you. And 1 hour later, she said to me, I know that you'll get this job. And I landed up walking into the Kix Group building in Searle Street and then had four men interviewing me, including the CEO. And it was like, I was just myself. And they made me an offer 3 days later. So that was it. I was in with the music head team, management team, and then went on to be part of the Kix Exco. So that was a very interesting years of giving up everything. The night before I got went into my first office, I watched an Alanis Morissette video and I cried. Because for me, Benji, that was the end in many ways. I was 37 years old and it had been sad, mad, dreadful, enjoyable, ecstatic times with Tim and Elemental. But I realized that this was a closing of a door on some level for me. And so the next 11 years were pretty much dedicated to bringing up the kids, really making sure that I would support them. That was it.
But then the Muse came knocking on the doors and there was a reunion at some point. When was that, last year?
Last year, yeah.
But no Joburg date. I know there are a lot of unhappy people. What happened?
I got together with Adrian. He lives down the road from me. And we bashed out and remembered. It was actually quite fun remembering some of those old songs. And we spent about 2 weeks together getting a set together. We'd spoken to Herman, who we haven't seen for 36 years. It's been that long. We decided we'd fly him out and have 4 days rehearsal in Cape Town, and we would do four shows. It was Herman who actually didn't want to come to Joburg. He wanted to have a holiday with his family. So that's why we didn't do a Joburg gig. We were actually very keen to do a Joburg gig, as our audience, where we started, was Joburg. And we still owe them a concert sometime.
Yeah. Wow, that was going to be my next question, folks. Can we expect an Elemental reunion tour?
One day. I think it would be a good thing to do.
I would certainly, yeah. I think that it's something that I'm not necessarily desperate to do.
Mm-hmm.
What is important, again, to go back to one of my first points, the audience, if they really want this to happen, we have to know that we're not going to do what we did just over a year ago, because it's not easy to expect without any kind of support funding-wise to try and lug and do the shit that I was doing when I was 23 at 63. It's no fun. It really, really isn't. It was tricky and not enough people, not enough talking. We could have spoken a lot more as a team before. So, yes, it was like automatic pilot for me getting on and singing the songs. I also struggled with my voice because I'd had my thyroid removed. The vibe that we are definitely 40 years separate. That's what I felt afterwards. And I know that the audience loved it, and I did enjoy singing for the audience. I would hesitate to try and do this under so much pressure that we put ourselves. I would like it to be as relaxed and as supportive of the band doing it as possible. And I would rather probably put together our another band to work with us. Tim and I are still very connected. You know, it's so beautiful to sing with Tim. It makes my heart happy. And that's what brought us together in the very beginning was the music. So, yes, there's never a no from me, but there's certainly certain conditions in order for it to happen. And, you know, then I'll bring my best.
Tim, what's your take on it?
I agree. Yeah, I'd like it to happen, but also we Roddy asked us to play at the Johnny Clegg thing because Johnny was our friend. We managed to play with Andy Innes as the musical director, the keyboard player, and Denham Harding, the bass player, is the most ridiculous drummer.
Ridiculous musician.
Oh, it was Concord on bass, and we rehearsed for a couple of hours. They just got it without it being pressured. I mean, we actually had fun that day, Ed, and when we performed those couple of songs, there was such a lovely reaction from the Joburg audience. It was a different energy playing with those guys who, I mean, just watching them in the studio get the songs together in those 2 hours, scoring their parts and their little chats. Oh, no, put this there. It was lovely to see. And Denham and I have been talking, and he would be my first choice as a drummer if Heather was happy. And he says there's all these incredible musicians here in Joburg who could score the set. I mean, Heather and I actually went through a whole lot of bass players and drummers before Herman and Adrian. When Gary left us, I mean, it was such heartache. Gary kept on getting arrested. We had to go and bail him out from John Forster Square, and eventually someone sent him a ticket, so him and his wife left for France. When we got Adrian, we dropped him in the deep end. He was 17 years old and 3 days rehearsal and he was in the band. If we did a gig in Joburg, I would visualize us, Heather and I, having time to rehearse and get it together properly. Not 1 day rehearsal and go and perform.
Well, don't leave it too late. You know? I hope it happens, and I hope people that Elemental fans that listen to the podcast, maybe there'll be some people amongst them who go, you know what, that's something worth investing in. Heather Mack, Tim Parr, what an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for your time, for your memories. When you look back at Elemental, what are you proudest of?
That we touched a lot of people. That comes back to me all the time. And we grew a lot as people to go through all that.
Yeah, I'm proud of the fact of inspiring. I think inspiring future musicians that I've met as well, that makes me very happy. And also the fact that songs touched people and they felt like they were transported somewhere else. That's the stuff that makes me most proud.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.
Small-minded people living in a small town. They in with small ideas, nothing else around. Oh yeah, knowing everybody's move from A to Z, what they're trying to be. When castles crumble into the sea, lost and gained, not just a day.
You smelt rich. You went shopping every Wednesday, but you talked without meaning. I saw a girl looking for truth, probing the cracks in the pavement. I saw a lawyer with sense for eyes. I saw a doctor who did not care. I saw a rich man and a poor man. And all these people meant something to somebody. But what is my truth? What is my meaning?
Every time I wonder what it must be like, I get so down.